From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Oh, yes, indeed. Good day, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be listening. This is the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio. It is Wednesday, June 20th, 2012, and we are broadcasting from our studios in the Feeding Arizona complex in Youngtown, Arizona, which is also home to the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. This is going to be one of our heading down to the Short Rows last broadcast from this location. We'll be changing locations here right around the first of the month. Valley View Community Food Bank is moving into very large facilities, about 36,000 square feet of food bank and thrift shop and other activities that they'll be conducting there, all for the betterment of people in need in the Northwest Phoenix area. So we wish them well, and we will be probably doing some shows from their new location as well at some point in the future. So we will be moving to a different location, however, and when we find our new permanent light, we will make sure to let everybody knows where that is. But the shows will continue nonetheless. We'll be doing some remotes and some other shows from different locations around the area. So the shows will continue just as they always have, no change there. And I'm Pete Peters, and I want to remind our listeners that the Boomer the Babe Incorporated is involved in much more than just this radio show. We do things such as write and publish mini-books. We publish people's e-books. Many of those e-book authors also have their own show here on Blog Talk Radio, Boomer and the Babe Network. And we'll be having those folks on a regular basis, just as we always have. And in addition to that, we do a little bit of work with regard to moving content and in any way that people need to have their content moved and their expertise brought out into the public, so they will know exactly what we're doing, and people will know what they're doing, quite frankly. Our guest today is, we're waiting for our guest to call in. She should be here shortly. I thought she was on the switchboard, but she has gone off the switchboard again, apparently. So at any rate, we'll be getting to her when she calls in. We'll give it a few minutes. But the Boomer the Babe is also involved in doing a magazine, an online magazine called Boomer Experience Speaks. Some of the big news with regard to Boomer Experience Speaks. Well, first of all, a lot of the contributors to Boomer Experience Speaks have been guests on our show, or they are people that have their own books and have their own shows with us on the regular show. So follow up on that, because we're going to be certainly within the next 30 to 45 days, we'll be posting that on the Apple network, on their bookstore. So that magazine will be up and available. And I can see that our guest is here right now, and I think we have her. Is this Christina?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Christina. This is Pete, Boomer the Babe Show. Thanks for joining us. I'm glad you could make it.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm great. How are you?
Oh, that's good. I was just doing a few preliminary things here before you came on, and I want to let people know exactly what we're going to be talking about with you. Of course,
sure.
You are Christina Wright, an award-winning author whose erotica and erotic romance fiction has appeared in over 75 anthologies. Christina is a member of the Erotica Readers and Writers Association, Romance Writers of America, and Passionate Inc., INK. She has also received the Golden Heart Award for Romantic Suspense from RWA for her first novel, Dangerous Curves. She has a BA in English and an MA in Humanities with an emphasis on women's studies and popular culture. Christina teaches both English and Humanities at a college level. And welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show, Christina. We're glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
Well, to get started, normally, Deborah's not here today. She sometimes is and sometimes isn't. Lately, we've got so many other things going off air. She's tending to some of those today. She would ask you for your 2-minute movie, a little bit more of your background other than the short bio that I just read. Who is Christina Wright, and where do you hail from? And tell us anything you want to tell us that you feel comfortable with.
Sure. 2 minutes. Oh, gosh. I'll make this quick. I'm Christina Wright. I am a writer and editor for Cleus Press. I have been writing romance and erotic fiction for far longer than I care to admit. I am the wife of a naval officer and the mother of a 2-year-old and a 10-month-old, and I live in Virginia.
So you're on the right coast, I guess, huh? Versus
yeah, right in more ways than one.
Well, okay then. Well, I always get a series of suggested questions and points of discussion from Cleus Press or anybody else that might be sending authors such as, and editors such as yourself along, and then I come up with a few of my own. But
sure.
I like to try to find out a little bit more sometimes about people. How did you ever get involved in becoming a writer/editor? Where did that spark come from?
Honestly, it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I know that sounds cliched, but since I was in first grade, and I'm not kidding, I wrote my very first short story in first grade, and when I realized that people actually got to write the books that I love to read, I knew that was the job for me. So I thought as I got older I would be practical and go, you know, major in journalism, which is very ironic since we all know that journalism has pretty much folded in the advent of the internet and news blogs and syndication and whatnot. So being a full-time journalist is no longer the lucrative career that it once was. So I majored in English, and I have taught college-level English, and I would, you know, I will probably always want to teach, but writing is just something I've always wanted to do. It was my calling from a very, very young age, and I'm happy to say. I guess it's kind of boring to say I've been, you know, pursuing this for 40 years, but that's the truth.
No, that's what it is. That's what it is. There's nothing wrong with that. You mentioned something about the internet and journalism.
Sure.
And journalism isn't what it once was, and so on and so forth. I'd like to have your opinions and your observations on what's really going on. Not so much the content of what people are writing. We know that they'll write anything,
mm-hmm.
and they will hold them out as an expert because they wrote something that was published and they can refer to it. I've written a blog myself about how to be an expert and what that takes, and all you have to do is write a few words and throw it up on the internet, and all of a sudden you can be an expert. But what is your view of that? I mean, you said journalism is kind of gone by the boards. What are you referring to there? Is it with regard to actual journalism as far as finding a story, doing the research, and publishing it? Or is there something else that you're hitting at there when you mentioned that statement?
Well, I'm referring more to the 24/7 ability to get news from anywhere now. I grew up with the morning newspaper and the afternoon edition of the newspaper, which afternoon editions exist in very few places, if at all, anymore. And you had the 5 o'clock news, the 6 o'clock news, and maybe the 10 or 11 o'clock news, and that was your news source. And these days, you know, with the internet, everything is syndicated, so a column that's written in New York or L.A. is picked up by everyone, so there's no need to hire local journalists to write those particular articles because they can pull it off the wire and run it that way. You've got news sources like Huffington Post, which the pool of writers that's writing for Huffington Post is enormous, and, you know, varied degrees of talent there. Some are brilliant writers and, you know, certainly professional writers, and then, of course, there are those that are aspiring writers, and, you know, not to negate anybody's ability to write a good news story. But I do think think some things aren't vetted as well as they should be on the internet. And a lot of people are getting their news from, you know, various blogs, popular blogs that are maybe the membership or the following is, you know, a few thousand people, and it's all well and good. But, again, the information isn't necessarily vetted like it would for a professional journalism source. Of course, you know, there are those that will argue that the dinosaur that, you know, journalism has become this, you know, huge conglomerate of people controlling the news that you receive. So an argument can maybe be made in either direction, I suppose, as far as the validity of it. I love the internet. I love the ability to read people's opinions on things, but a lot of times what's somebody's opinion is presented as fact, and, you know, obviously you have to take everything you read with a grain of salt. So, and being in a military family, I certainly see both sides of that coin as far as military stories are presented.
Well, I do believe 100% of what you're saying there, that you do have to take it with a grain of salt, because you don't know who that person is. You don't know how much research was done. And you don't know if it's just something that they picked up from somebody else, and they
right.
based their findings for their article or blog, whatever it might be, on something that somebody else has said that might be completely bogus. I mean, we hear about that all the time anymore, don't we? The fact that all of a sudden somebody's followed up with something and grabbed it and ran with it, and then realizes,
sure.
and they have to say, "Oops, sorry."
Yeah.
You know,
well,
there's a lot of
oops the professional
going on
journalist.
Right now.
Right. Even the professional journalists get caught up in the hoaxes that are perpetuated on the internet. But, you know, when people are using Jon Stewart, who, you know, I love Jon Stewart and his show, but when you're using Jon Stewart as your source of news, I think you're going to have some problems with accuracy of detail.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And the fact that I just saw something on television not that long ago that they did a survey, or they asked some people questions about who their news source was.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. There, some of them were Jon Stewart's. Some of them were
Stephen
Colbert. Exactly.
Right.
And then the really interesting thing is, and this is a little off the subject for where we're going to go here in a minute, but
mm-hmm.
I always marvel at, if ever I have an opportunity to watch the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and
mm-hmm.
he does his jaywalking segment.
Right.
And he asks people if they know who somebody is, can they identify them, and these folks have no earthly clue. And
right.
If, you know, and they'll hold up a picture of somebody, and they'll say, "Who is that?" And they'll say, "Well, I think I've seen that picture somewhere else." And he'll start to give him some clues, and they'll give him a name, and he says, "No, that's Condoleezza Rice." or and they'll come up with, I don't know, Aunt Jemima or something. I don't know, because she happens to be a black woman that's been on the cover of a cereal box or something.
Right.
It's just unbelievable that these people are so ill-informed and get information from such shaky sources.
Sure.
It goes
and
a
even,
long way.
Even a segment like that, though, from what I understand, that it's actually staged. That they, I mean, and it bothers me that they would, you know, stage it so that people look stupid, but they do skip over the people that actually know the answers to find people that are either willing to be on television and look dumb or honestly don't know the answer. So again, we're looking at, you know, an entertainment source to judge the intelligence of the average American. And
I know, yeah. And those people don't care, they just want their 5 minutes of fame.
Well, sure, absolutely.
That's what they want. Well, let's talk about your academic background. How does your academic background influence your writing?
Well, I'm one of those English majors that's not necessarily a literary snob. While I adore the classics and the canon of great literature is on my shelves, it's hard to stray away from my roots as a genre writer to focus only on the, you know, quote-unquote literary fiction. I think there's room for all of it. And so being a English major who felt kind of disenfranchised by the classics, which tend to be the, you know, old, dead white guys, there's not a lot of room in that particular area of literary entertainment, I guess, or value there for someone who is, you know, currently female and alive and writing erotica. or writing romance. So I kind of found myself, you know, I've always been writing, so I kind of found myself when I was in grad school taking classes that were as far away from the original roots of, you know, Shakespeare and John Donne and whatnot to explore other areas of fiction. So I took a lot of minority fiction, women writers and African-American writers and American Asian writers and Irish writers and whatnot to kind of explore what else was out there as far as literary fiction was concerned. And I find a lot of that comes back to me in the stories that I write. So I have a deep interest in mythology, and while I do love the UK and European fiction is some of my favorites, I have edited a collection recently, a fairy tale erotic romance, which is basically taking the classics such as the Grimm fairy tales and Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales and retelling them with kind of an erotic twist, which everybody raises an eyebrow and says, you're taking the childhood stories and making them sexy. And it's, yes, that's true, but if you read the original fairy tales as they were originally told by, say, the Grimm brothers, there was a lot of sex and violence going on in those original stories because they were supposed to be cautionary tales about what happens to, you know, bad boys and girls who don't listen to their parents. So there were, you know, violent scenes and sexual scenes and mutilations and all sorts of things. So that, to me, kind of shows what we're missing in the literary academic community is that sense of variety that we have now in terms of you can walk into a bookstore and pick up the original fairy tales, you can pick up the Disney version of the fairy tales, you can pick up the young adult version of the fairy tales, and now you can pick up the erotic version because I've edited a collection of them. So as far as my academic background, I find there's good literature in every area. It's just overlooked sometimes in the academic world because we like things to stay the same, and so we will hold on to the classics forever, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I think there's room for growth, and in terms of there are a lot of good 20th and 21st century writers that are writing amazing fiction that hopefully will find its way into classrooms, and in some places I know it is, but hopefully it will find its way into even, you know, high school classrooms and whatnot. It's sad to me that there's so many kids walking around saying they hate reading or they hate books or they hate poetry, and I feel like so much of it is on the instructors and the teachers, even at a younger level, to instill that love of reading and not necessarily be so tied to we have to teach, you know, Shakespeare at 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade. We have to teach this particular, we have to teach Jane Austen to kids who don't necessarily have any sort of familiarity with the background and cannot make the connections. So I guess that's a very long way of saying that I want to tell stories, but I also want people to read stories. And hopefully I'm telling stories that entertain as well as educate.
Are you at all concerned, for instance, I've got two granddaughters. The 6-year-old is a voracious reader. I mean, it's just, it does good. My heart good, her parents' heart good. Deborah is a voracious reader, and so Grandma Deb is just overjoyed when she sees that child with a book in her hands. We gave her a dictionary, her first dictionary for Christmas, mm-hmm. and she had all these other gifts that she was opening, and she's found the dictionary, and she sat down in the chair and started to read the dictionary and forgot
about
all
of it. That's wonderful.
Well, it is wonderful. It absolutely is wonderful. But are you at all concerned as an educator, as a writer, and
mm-hmm.
classically, that we're losing some of that? I mean, and I'm not talking about necessarily in schools, but I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about more just generally speaking, that there's not as much emphasis, even by parents, put on that aspect of child's development.
You mean reading?
Yes.
It does concern me. I one of my jobs, I worked in the children's department actually at the public library for almost 5 years, and saw, you know, the parents bringing the kids in, saw the teachers coming in, you know, classrooms with kids, saw the preschoolers and that. It's concerning because I think there's a lot of external distractions for kids these days that I didn't necessarily have. We had TV, but that was the extent of it. And, you know, Atari came along, so, and I'm showing my age. But with the internet, I think it's made it far more easy to be distracted away from reading. My 2.5-year-old does love to read his books, and he will sit and, you know, study his books. And he's obviously not reading them, but he's learning the process. But I think I think long before they get into school, it's important for the books to be in the house and to bring your kids to the library and to sit them down and read to them before they can read, and to give them books that it's okay if they bend the pages, and it's okay if, you know, they aren't kept in pristine condition, because that's the other thing. A lot of parents won't let their kids touch books in the library because they're afraid they're going to mess them up. So, you know, buy your kids a few books and give them to them and let them know that they own them. Because I think book ownership at a young age is probably one of the most important things that made me a reader. I had the Scholastic Book Club in school, and so that, you know, again, I was a voracious reader by the time, you know, the same age as your granddaughter, and would read, and, you know, anything you put in front of me, from the cereal box to the newspaper. And granted, didn't understand all the big words in the newspaper, but it was still, you know, it was in the house and I read it. So I think that a big part of it is getting the parents to, a lot of parents don't have time to read. I know I mean, I'm a writer and an editor, and, you know, the irony is I don't have as much time for pleasure reading as I would like, but I think it's important for kids to also see their parents reading and their grandparents reading, because, you know, that kids do as you, don't necessarily do as you tell them, they do what they see. And if they see you, you know, chilling out in front of the television all day, or in front of, you know, whatever, World of Warcraft all day, that's what they're going to want to do. If they send you, you know, laying on the couch reading a book, or hanging out in the backyard, you know, reading even a magazine, it's going to interest them. They're going to want to know, you know, what it's all about. So, yeah, it does concern me on a variety of levels. And now that I have two young children of my own, and they're boys, and boys generally tend to read less and fall away from the love of reading quicker than girls do, because it's not cool in school. So I'm looking at it not only from an educator's perspective, but from a parenting perspective of how do I engage them, how do I make them, encourage them to read? How do I instill that love at an early age? Because they will fall away from it. Sports will become more important, or their friends will become more, whatever. At some point, most kids kind of drop off their reading and focus on other things. But if the love has been instilled at a really early age, they will come back to it.
You had mentioned in the course of these various topics we've already discussed, that you have done a collection, or probably several collections, if I remember correctly, of anthologies of erotic fairy tales in particular.
Right.
I'm looking at the current book that they've sent me, which is Lustfully Ever After, and I was reading the back cover of that, and it's amazing that there are, as you said, adult versions, in essence, of these various fairy tales that we all know. And we have seen, we like to watch Grimm. Have you ever seen Grimm on television?
Yes, yes.
Deborah and I enjoy watching that, and it's amazing when you stop and think and you relate it to the Grimm Brothers stories, how it's been modernized, how it's been updated, how it's been adultified, I guess, if there is such a word. And I can remember as a young person watching cartoons on television, and one of them that I watched was Rocky and Bullwinkle. I loved Rocky and Bullwinkle, but that was not a kid's cartoon.
No, it really wasn't. And I know I've had the same thought myself. I'm probably a little bit younger than you, but I did watch, you know, the reruns of Rocky and Bullwinkle and the Flintstones and whatnot. And the thing about the Flintstones, that's the one that I always thought, well, gee, when you grow up, it feels awfully immature, because Wilma was always, like, crying over Fred's got another woman. And I'm like, okay, that wasn't very kid-friendly. So, no, there's a lot of stuff in the entertainment world right now that we put in front of our children, or let our children, you know, digest, thinking that, oh, it's okay for them. But there are adult themes and a lot of things that kids are exposed to. So it really is a matter of how much they understand and comprehend at a young age. But, yes, I think it's, you know, Rocky Bullwinkle and the violence and the whole undercurrent of, you know, the enemy and, you know, the American patriotism that was, you know, and the kids weren't getting that. They were getting that it was a moose and a squirrel, and wasn't that fun?
Exactly. What do you think the appeal is of erotic fairy tales? And there seems to be a pretty, I guess, erotica right now is a pretty hot genre, isn't it? And what do you think that appeal is?
I think the appeal of erotic fairy tales is that sense of familiarity you get with reading a story, a retelling of Beauty and the Beast, and I do have a lovely retelling in Lustfully Ever After of Beauty and the Beast. But getting that sense of familiarity of, okay, I know this story, I've read something, you know, I'm familiar with the tropes of the story and the characters, but also having that twist of it being erotic. It's comforting, but it's also titillating. And there's sexuality is one of those things that, you know, if you're an adult, is a part of your life. Hopefully, it's a part of your life, and your sexual identity is important to you. But we don't necessarily get a lot of literature that's presented to us in a positive way. What I mean by that is a lot of literature that portrays sexuality portrays it in a negative way. A woman is raped. That's not portrayed as an erotic thing. It's a violent thing, or something bad happens to a character that, you know, enjoys sex, and it, you know, it's that back to that cautionary tale of, oh, you better not do this because this is what happens to you. So we don't get a lot of positive portrayals of sexuality in literature. So when you read something that not only is a familiar kind of story, a Cinderella tale, if you will, it's comforting in that regard, and there's that, you know, suspension of disbelief. You get to have that magic feel that, you know, we don't get that a lot as an adult. We don't get to just fantasize and enjoy the magic of a particular story unless it's film. And we, you know, we all sit in the dark movie theater for a couple hours. We get to be transported, but to be able to do it in a book or a story, I think, has its own appeal because you can pick it up, put it down at will. You can read it right before you go to bed. You can read it, you know, wherever. You can read it on your Nook or your Kindle, and while you're sitting at a football game, you know. But I think the fairy tales they're classic, and as you pointed out with Grimm being updated, it's a lot like Shakespeare. It can be reinterpreted at any era for any group of people, regardless of age or background. So that's what timeless literature is. The story is at its core is so universal that everybody can step into the story and have an appreciation of it. So I do it with an erotic twist because I think portraying sexuality in a very positive and enlightening and, you know, exciting way is important for a society that, you know, we put out these violent games and films and whatnot, and we're so desensitized to violence, but you show a woman's breasts on TV and everybody's up in arms over it, or you know, describe a sex scene in a story, you know, describe a sexual experience, and people, you know, it's taboo. So, and I don't understand that, because to me, you know, sex is the natural thing, the violence is not. But it's very much a cultural thing, and so I like to see the positive benefits that come out of reading literature that is redeeming in some way, and I do believe that erotica is redeeming because, well, for one, I get a lot of letters from people saying that, you know, it gave them their own ideas for things that they were interested in, or they didn't know that they were interested in this, or they didn't think they would like this particular story, but it's really opened their mind, and I don't think there's anything wrong with opening people's minds to new things.
Right. I would say, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm going to guess that there are a lot of people now, because of the what seems to be the hot genre, as I think I mentioned before, of erotica. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are coming to that genre of stories and novels and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell them about erotica? What should they look for? What are they? What could they expect, generally speaking?
Not every erotica story is the same. Much like, you know, every mystery or horror novel or horror movie, there are certain things that you can expect in erotica. You can expect that there will be explicit sex. You can expect that there will be some sort of scenario in which obviously the people have to have some sort of erotic relationship, even if they've just met. It's, you know, at some point things are going to spin in, off into an erotic direction. Don't judge one story, or don't judge all erotica by one story. I know 50 Shades of Grey is the very popular trilogy right now, and a lot of people's introduction to erotica or erotic romance is from this particular series or trilogy of books. So if you loved 50 Shades of Grey, welcome to erotica. There's a huge, great big world of it. It's not a new genre. It's been out there for quite a while. And, you know, just look around. I mean, there's a lot of lists of, you know, if you liked 50 Shades of Grey, what to read next, or if you didn't like 50 Shades of Grey but you still want to read erotica, here's what to read next. And I think the accessibility of erotica is getting to the point where it's not a hidden thing anymore. Even the bookstores are carrying it in paperback. But if, you know, if you have access to a bookstore, or even if you have access to Amazon, Amazon lists their top-selling erotica novels and erotic romance novels. And a lot of people say, well, what's the difference between erotica and erotic romance? And basically, I tend to focus on erotic romance, which basically means you're getting a relationship with your sex. Erotica may or may not have a relationship involved. It may be two people that have just met. It may be two people who have no relationship beyond the sexual aspect of their contact. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you like, it may be, you know, the core of the story might be a mystery or a thriller or some sort of paranormal, you know, vampire story, but there will be sex, but just necessarily won't be the relationship. So erotic romance is not necessarily less sexual. I personally think it's just as, there's just as much sex in erotic romance. You just tend to get a happily ever after or happy for now sort of ending with erotic romance, where you may not get that with erotica. So there's a lot out there. I welcome people to stop by my blog or my Facebook or follow me on Twitter. I try to recommend books that I like, but I've also edited several anthologies now for Cleos Press, including Best Erotic Romance, which came out in December. And honestly, if people are looking for a good starting point for erotica, Best Erotic Romance is contemporary short fiction. There are 17 stories in the collection, and they are all very hot, and all of the authors have other stories that they've written or novels that they've written. So short fiction isn't necessarily your thing. You know, you can still pick up the collection, read 17 stories, find authors that you really like, you know, go Google them or check them out on Amazon, and at least half of them have written, you know, novel-length fiction that you will probably also find appealing. But if you're new to the genre itself, just know that, you know, you have to figure out what you like to read. And it's just like some people like Stephen King and some people don't like him. And some people like to read the hard-boiled detective mysteries, and some people like prefer the mysteries that are, you know, what they call cozies, which is the small-town country, you know, detective doing, you know, solving the little mysteries and nobody ever actually really gets hurt. So just like in the mystery genre, erotica, there's a wide range of types of stories. Like, you know, you explore what's out there. Anthologies are always a popular way to introduce yourself to a variety of new authors. And, summertime is a great time to be reading erotica, too, because it tends to be when the bookstores, the real bookstores and the online bookstores are promoting, because it's seen as, you know, it's not a serious kind of fiction. It's more for escapism, which, you know, you could debate it one way or the other, but for whatever reason, just like summer movies tend to be the more lighthearted, fun movies, the erotica tends to be the summer genre to read. So right now is a really great time to be picking up some of the new books that are out there.
Especially here in Arizona when it's 113 degrees, it's a good time to be staying inside in an air-conditioned house reading.
I'll tell you what, it's in the mid-90s here in Virginia. I'm in Southeast Virginia, Norfolk, and I'm from South Florida, so I know about hot summers, and sometimes all you want to do is either, you know, sit inside the air conditioning or sit out by the pool. So
I wrote down a series of words in really in no particular order, and you've kind of gone through this already in what you were saying earlier. But I wrote down, and I'm trying to figure that if there maybe was a relation one to the other, and maybe there was a progression. And I think I'm kind of hearing you say that. And I wrote down romance novel, erotica, bodice ripper, porn.
Okay.
At what point does I don't want to get into a huge discussion about pornography, but
sure.
I mean, it's that old thing about I don't know what porn is, but I know it when I see it, kind of a thing.
Right.
But at what point does something go from erotic or erotica into pornography? What do you think is the dividing line?
Well, generally, porn is used to describe visuals, pictures or movies. It's not usually used with regard to literature, unless it's used in a derogatory. I've never heard anybody say, "Oh, that was a great porn book." It's usually used in a derogatory term. Whereas, you know, there actually are adult film awards, you know, for the porn industry, and so.
Correct.
I don't know if that makes sense, but generally the term porn is used to, you know, describe the visual. But I think what you're saying is what's the difference between something that actually has some sort of literary redemption, you know, value as a piece of literature as opposed to it's just straight up about, you know, people having sex. I think that's for the reader to decide. I've certainly written stuff that readers have loved, even though it was very, very sexual, and then, you know, other readers weren't necessarily expecting it, and so tend to turn away from the eroticism that's presented. I guess the original saying was, I don't know what art is, but I know it when I see it, and, you know, I guess that applies to erotica as well. If it is a sexual story, it's just like everybody's real life sex lives. You know, everybody has their own opinion of what's normal, what's right, how much is too much, how much is enough. And the same thing is true of the genre, the written genre. I don't know that you can necessarily make, but the bodice ripper term it dates back to, you know, the 70s when the romance novels really started to, you know, kind of come on the radar for women, and they're mostly historical novels, and most of the women were portrayed on the cover with their, you know, flowing dresses and their breasts hanging out and the big, you know, hot masculine looking guy standing behind them, and so that term kind of has been perpetuated for 30 something years.
It's Fabio.
yes, exactly, Fabio and the like. I think it's used generally as a negative term. Right now we've got the 50 Shades of Grey popularity has apparently coined the phrase mommy porn, because apparently that's who's reading the newest erotic craze of novels are the, you know, the mothers. Well, I'm a mother and I, you know, not only read it, I write it. So, but mommy porn is what is today what chick lit was a decade ago. It was, you know, kind of is, for some reason, for whatever reason, women's fiction tends to get kind of a negative association. And maybe it's because it's just, you know, because it's for women, I don't know, or women, because women enjoy it. Although I will say that I get just as many male readers as I get female readers, but maybe men just aren't as inclined to say, hey, I read erotica or I read erotic romance. But
Right. As you're writing, in your process of actually writing a piece of work, does it? I mean, I'm sure you probably have some kind of a storyline that you write, that you outline somehow, whatever. And I don't know exactly what you do, but as you're writing along, is it possible that the story can move in a different direction and become how can I say this? I'll just say it. With a whole hell of a lot more erotica in it and a whole hell of a lot more sex than you had initially anticipated, because it just takes you there?
Sure.
Does that happen that way?
Yeah. Every writer has their own process, and I get that question all the time. Well, where do you get your ideas? How do you do it? Every story is different. Sometimes it depends on the length. Sometimes it depends on if I'm writing for a particular theme, if I'm writing, you know, for a particular market, or if I'm just writing for my own, hey, I have this idea, I'm going to write this idea. But sure, you can end up with a story that's supposed to be this very, you know, poignant kind of innocent, you know, sexual encounter, and it can just go off the charts. But it can also, it can become anything. You know, I start out usually with one particular scene in mind, and it's usually how the story is going to end, and I work from the back forward generally. Sometimes I start with, you know, some scene in the beginning, but I may know the beginning and the end, and the middle I have to fill it in, and yeah, it can go very erotic. It can take a whole new, you know, level that I was not expecting. I've had that happen even with stories that I absolutely know I have to write, like for Less Labor, after I wrote kind of a reverse Little Mermaid story that has, you know, paranormal elements, and it starts out as this kind of sad, you know, woman abandoned sort of story, and it didn't feel like it was going to be all that. It felt like it was going to be more of a sensual story and less actual sex, and it turned out to be pretty hot. But I think once I got into the story and realized that, well, she's having to make this break from her own reality and rediscovering who she really is, and that's not just, that's a psychological perspective as well as a physical perspective, it just felt right to have it be more sexual. Sometimes it works out that way. Sometimes it goes the other way when I'm thinking, I've actually literally written stories and I'll be 25 pages into it and I'm like, wait, there's not been any sort of sex. Okay, what's going on here? So, and then I have to kind of, if it's supposed to be erotica and there's no sex, that's not going to really work. So I have to either throw it aside and say, well, I'll write it for something else, or I have to kind of backtrack and say, okay, what's the issue that there hasn't been anything necessarily sexual happening yet? So
she just hasn't met the right guy.
And well, that's possible, but when you have characters doing a lot of introspective scenes or there's a lot of dialogue and you feel like it's just not getting anywhere and it's supposed to be erotic, sometimes it's supposed to be a novel and they just haven't actually, you know, hit the point where it's supposed to happen yet. And that's probably the hardest thing to do. Erotica is one of the hardest genres to write, I think, because you have to create a realistic sex scene. It's all fine and good to say, hey, they met in a bar and they were having sex in the bathroom before, you know, the first song was ever. That's great. That's fantasy. But to write a really good erotic story, you have to make it convincing. So it's difficult to get people from, hey, I just met you, to, hey, let's have sex in a convincing way, you know, that is, it doesn't start to become redundant because you can only have so many, you know, club hookup stories before it's starting to get boring. So I love exploring why people are together emotionally and sexually. And so I do a lot of stories about, you know, long-term married couples. I do a lot of stories about couples that have split up but, you know, reunited for whatever reason. So I've done stories about, you know, sex after illness or sex after having a child or whatnot. And while that sounds very boring and realistic, I think it ends up being hotter because it allows the reader to kind of sit in that position and say, yeah, I've been in that place. I've had the breakup, or I've had the baby, or I've had the long-term illness or the whatever separation. And I think it brings the reader into the story and gives them a framework that they understand.
So as you're saying, it's difficult to write. And then, so mm-hmm. I guess that kind of begs the question, is that can anybody write erotica? And how do they go about doing it if they wanted to try?
I think, you know, I actually got this question from a college student who hadn't actually had sex yet, asking me, can I write erotica? I'm like, if you fantasize about sex, you can write about sex. If you have an interest in sexuality or, you know, an interest in exploring why people do what they do in terms of emotional or sexual contact or connections that they make, absolutely you can write about sex. You can write erotica. I think it's important to read it and understand what it is. A lot of times I'll get, and I've read hundreds upon hundreds of short stories because people submit them to me from all over the world. And a lot of times I can tell when somebody has not read erotica and they're writing it based on penthouse letters, or they're writing it based on some, you know, adult film that they've watched where, you know, the pizza man shows up and there's pizza and there's sex. And there's room for that. There certainly is. but that's not necessarily what I'm looking for in my collections. So I think it's important, if you're interested in writing it professionally and actually seeing your work published, that you read a lot of it. Read, it's such a tough job reading erotica for work, right? Read it and understand the framework that you're working with, that you can write about sex, but you're going to have to convince the reader that you know what you're talking about, that the characters are acting in a way that is reasonable for them to act. You're not going to have a woman who has, let's see, how can I, I'm trying to think of a good example, but you're not going to have a character who has had a sexually traumatic experience and then is going to say, hey, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I've seen rape fiction. There's a difference between rape fantasy and rape fiction that's way too deep for this interview, but I've seen rape fiction written like it's supposed to be erotic, and that's not what erotica is. Erotica is about mutual sexual pleasure of the character. So if you can understand that, you can certainly write it. And I encourage people to write it, because I think it's not only good, even if you never get published, you know, write to your lover, write to your spouse, write for yourself, write your fantasies, because I think it's important to explore those aspects of sexuality. We're not really taught a whole lot about sex except, you know, don't do it, or use protection when you do it, or don't do it outside of marriage. So, and there's a lot of don'ts in our sexual agenda in this country. So I think it's important for people to kind of explore, hey, why I watched that movie with that little scene that was about sex, and why did I like it, and what was it about it? Was it a power dynamic that attracted me? Was it you know, the fact that she was in charge of what was going on? Was, you know, explore that. So even if you only do it for yourself, I think it's important to write about sex and write about what fantasies are interest you. But if you're interested in being published, I certainly encourage people to check out the Erotica Readers and Writers Association blog or website. They post all kinds of calls for submissions. And, you know, read what's out there. Read my anthologies. Read the novels that are being written that are erotica or erotic romance. A lot of people don't realize that the difference between being a writer and not being a writer is really just sitting down and writing. And if you write it and read it and make an attempt to send it out into the world to be published, it's really about perseverance.
What is it that you enjoy reading? I'm assuming you enjoy reading erotica, because that's what
that is
your business. But I mean, what other types of things do you like to read, number one, and what else do you write?
Ah, okay. Yes, I enjoy reading erotica, although honestly, I don't get to read a lot of it for fun, simply because I read so much of it for work. So when I'm reading for pleasure, I tend to go away from it. I'm a big mystery fan. I do love mystery. I'm also reading a lot of women's fiction these days, which is basically stories or novels that are, you know, written by women, usually, you know, and they're written for women, and a lot of midlife stuff, women with children, women with, you know, marriages, and the whole bit, kind of rediscovering themselves. So that interests me as well. I read a lot of, in the last couple of years, I've read a lot of parenting books and memoirs necessarily, specifically about motherhood and being a good parent, because, wow, it's a tough thing to do. So that's what I'm currently reading. What I like to write other than erotica and erotic romance, wow, I have probably three novels that I'm currently playing with in various forms. One is a detective mystery that I kind of envision as being a series, and there's a psychic detective, which, so I like the paranormal elements. I tend to blend a lot of things. I don't just write erotica, I write erotic romance. I don't just write, you know, mystery, I write paranormal mystery. So I'm interested in blending a lot of different genres. So I've got the mystery book, I've got an erotic, kind of a erotic beach novel, I guess I would, it's kind of set in a seaside resort that I'm working on right now. And I am kind of starting to explore memoir, just because I'm interested in telling my stories, and a lot of people seem interested in my my background and how I became a writer. So I'm interested in writing more essays and creative nonfiction and telling my story about, you know, being a writer, being a mother, and how you blend the two.
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to mention to you, and I only wanted to bring this up if it came up kind of in the conversation, and that is how do you do this? I mean, how do you balance the writing and the editing career and a marriage and a family and obviously some kind of a military approach to things because your husband's in the military. I mean, there's a lot of things going on there. From a lot of different directions. And at what point do you make a mistake and say, well, I was talking about this, but oh, I shouldn't be talking about that here?
Does that ever... Well, you'd quickly discover, I don't think it's probably no big secret that I'm a liberal. I can have very liberal viewpoints on things, and I'm not necessarily in the most liberal part of the country. That's kind of what I meant when I said I'm on the right coast. It's very, you know, it tends to lean right. The military tends to lean right. So I learned to keep my mouth shut about my opinions unless I'm ready to be the only one in the room that, you know, feels the way I do, which I don't have a problem doing. I'm fine with being the dissenting voice in any argument, but, you know, for the sake of peace, I tend to keep quiet. My husband's a huge supporter. Honestly, I could not do what I do without him. He is, he has his own career. He's, you know, military, the Navy's, you know, he's been gone a lot over the course of our marriage. So when he's home, he is the perfect dad, the perfect husband, the perfect, you know, the biggest fan I have, and I could not write and edit and take off to go, you know. I was in New York City a couple of weeks ago for Book Expo America, which is a huge publishing convention, and he took leave to stay home with the kids, so I could take off for that. And, you know, that kind of thing, if I didn't have that kind of support from him, there's no way I could manage everything I do. But I'm also one of those people that, you know, the more I do, the more I can do. And I don't know if that makes any sense, but I have a lot of people say, well, I don't know how you find time to write with two little kids. I don't have any children at all, and I never find time to write. And I think that is the secret. If you have a block of time in your day and you know you only have that block of time in your day to do something, you will do it. If you have unstructured time and you have an entire week to do something, if nobody sets the deadline for you, the week's going to pass and you won't have accomplished anything. So for me, knowing that I have 4 hours a day or 5 hours a day to write and to edit and to put together this book and to submit this story and to do this interview, it focuses me. And I think I'm very self-disciplined. I can put off, generally, I'm very self-disciplined. I can put off the reward in order to do the work now because I know in the end I'll be happy that I did. And there's nothing quite like the feeling of accomplishing, you know, seeing something published or even just seeing something submitted, you know, I'm done. Okay, I can move on to the next thing. So the more I do, the more I seem to find time to do. Although once in a while I do absolutely take a break and breathe. And I honestly can say I haven't really done that too much. I've had two babies in, you know, less than 3 years. So, and published my seventh anthology with Cleus in the same period of time. So it's been a roller coaster the past few years of just, you know, trying to go from one thing to the next. But occasionally I take a weekend off, or take a day off in the middle of the week and say, okay, I'm just not going to do anything today, and it can all wait till tomorrow. And that recharging, that time off gives me a chance to just kind of recharge and regroup and, you know, process everything I've been working on and you know, readjust my priorities, because sometimes I find I say yes to a lot of things I don't necessarily want to do. But because I'm a people pleaser, I will say yes, and it gives me a chance when I'm taking a break to just look around and say, okay, what's important to me? What do I really want to be doing? What do I want to be doing 5 years from now? And I think it's important. Everybody does that, you know, once in a while, kind of reevaluate your situation. So
when you were talking about the fact that you're making light of the fact that you're on the right coast and you're a liberal person, and liberal thought processes. It reminds me of the story that Deborah tells. We live in Arizona, of course, which is, they think they're right. They think they're right, if you know what I'm talking about. And she would go to get her hair done. It brings this story comes to mind because she's having her hair done today this afternoon. And And she said she would never be able to say anything to anybody as she was having her hair done with regard to what was going on in Arizona or the country, because she was of a liberal mindset. And then finally she found a hairdresser that whispered to her, "Are you really a liberal?" And the hairdresser goes, Deborah says, yeah. And she says, "So am I, but I can't tell anybody here."
Yes, and that's kind of how it feels sometimes around here. So yeah, I understand. I was very pleased when I first moved here to discover that there are communities and you know, pockets of creative communities in the East Coast, not necessarily where I am, where the liberal thinking tends to be the stronger viewpoint. But I feel like things have gotten more conservative in the past couple of decades, and I've definitely seen a trend in the military of people becoming more conservative and more restrictive in their opinions and their ideologies. And you know, as a writer and as a writer of erotica in general, but just because I am, you know, I am a Democrat, I am a liberal politically and socially, it's discomforting for me to be in that kind of community. So there's a sense of isolationism about what I do as a writer, but also just my personality doesn't necessarily mesh with where we live. But the Navy just won't let us move where we want. I don't know what that's about. for the duration of his career, we are at the whim of the Navy. So I love where we live. I can't say that I don't. I do love Virginia. It's a beautiful state, and I have some very, very close friends here, but it does have that sense of, hey, you know, are you in the club? Are you one of us? So it's nice when you finally do meet someone that you feel like you can connect with on that kind of intellectual level.
Yes, yes, I understand. I used to be a pretty much diehard Republican, and there are too many things that are happening nowadays that I just can't fathom. And I don't want, like I said, I don't really want to get into much more of a political discussion because I could start railing. But the fact that I've got an 89-year-old mother, I've got Deborah with me, I've got my daughter and two granddaughters, and a female dog. I mean, I pretty much have to be in favor of women's rights. I have to be in favor of the various things that will make it a better world and a better life for the females of the world. And I cannot see that the other party is that.
Well, it makes it a better life for you too, right? I mean.
Well, it does. It does.
You know, I kind of don't understand. We shouldn't talk about politics, but I don't understand the mentality that women's rights are just for women when we're talking about things like birth control for women. Well, if you're a man and your woman you're with isn't using birth control, you now have a child to support. Oh, now you have another child to support. Okay, now you have another child to support. So I don't know. I think women's rights tends to be human rights in general. It's just giving women the voice that they need in order to do it. But yes, you're surrounded by women, so it's probably in your best interest just to be supportive.
Exactly. I'll close this part of the discussion by saying something that Deborah says. And that is, she says, all of these men are trying to run the thing the way they want to run the thing, and they say you can't have birth control, you can't have this, you can't have that. How many of you are going to take a foster child home?
Exactly.
You know, how many
I've yet to meet a pro-life individual who has adopted children, because it's all fine and good. And having had two babies in my 40s, I can tell you, pregnancy is not easy. And
right.
To say that every woman should have a child, whether she wants it or not, because she got pregnant, it's not to understand the process or just the physicality of it. So
right.
Just because you disagree with something doesn't mean you have to limit the rights of everyone else. If you don't like it, don't do it. If you don't like it, you know, don't marry someone who believes in it, but you don't get to limit everybody else's rights. I tend not to believe that everybody should run around with guns, but, you know, we have gun rights, and so
yeah,
I don't go around saying.
there comes a point when your right is trying to supersede my right, and you don't have that right.
I think things I remember a time when being a Republican or being a Democrat didn't mean being as far apart as the parties have gotten. It feels like something has happened in the past couple of decades that things are, have just become so contentious between both political sides. I don't know. It's upsetting. So I kind of get lost in my little fictional world and just, you know, sing my happy songs and think my happy thoughts.
Well, we're going to do a political show, and I'm going to call you.
Sounds like fun.
One last thing before we close the show off, I want to make sure that people understand and know where they can get your works and your edited works. For instance,
sure.
Lustfully Ever After. Give them any information you can about how they can get in touch with you, or if
okay.
they have something to submit, they can submit it to you, or
sure.
get the books, whatever you'd like to tell us.
Okay, I have a website. My name is Christina Wright, and my website is the same. It's Christina with a K, KristinaWright.com. You can also buy my books through my publisher, Cleis Press, which is CleisPress.com. You can also find me on Amazon if you Google my name, or you can Google Lustfully Ever After, search on Amazon for Lustfully Ever After. That will pull up that book, and you can click on my name and see all the books that I've edited or anything else I've written. I'm on Facebook, again, Christina Wright. You can find me there. You can find me on Twitter, Christina Wright. Pretty much, I'm probably going to come up in the top 10 hits if you search for my name with a K. And the last name is Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. I have, I think, currently 6 anthologies available on Amazon or through Cleis. And they also have, for those who are new to erotica, Cleis has some, they have a long and varied history of doing some amazing erotica anthologies, as well as some erotica novels that they're starting to do. So I think they are, while they're also doing, you know, publishing my stuff, I have to say that there are some amazing talents that they're publishing besides me, and I would really recommend that anyone that's interested in reading erotica or writing erotica check them out.
Well, I will say that I have an ongoing relationship with Cleis Press. They send me books and authors such as yourself, and they have other folks that we've had on the show, and not necessarily authors of erotica, but
sure.
they've got a fine stable of writers, and always enjoyable to talk to any of the people that they have in their group. So it's always fun.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, I enjoyed this, and I really appreciate the fact that you've kind of explained to me and probably our audience members somewhere along the line, a lot of audience folks, exactly what erotica is. Because sometimes people say it's erotica, and they go, and especially if they're of basically a conservative nature, they go, oh, that's nasty, that's dirty.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way.
No.
There's another way of looking at it, isn't there?
Sure, absolutely.
Well, I'd like to thank you for giving us that education. I think it's been a wonderful hour.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And it's gone by really fast.
It certainly has.
And if we do that political show, I just might give you a call.
Oh, absolutely. I'd be happy to give my opinions and share what little I know about politics. It's all based on personal experience, but you know, you hit a certain age and you kind of look around and look at your history and you say, wow, you've seen a lot of things change, and you kind of hope things, you know, kind of come back to center and I don't know, just live and let live. That's kind of a good political philosophy for me. If it's not hurting anyone, you know, let people be happy.
Exactly. Don't tell me what to do, I won't tell you what to do.
Exactly.
There it is. Well, Christina Wright, thank you very much for being on the show today. I certainly do appreciate it, and we'll touch base here. Maybe I'll give you a shout back here in the next couple of days. I got some other ideas that I think might be of interest to you to
Great.
Help you publicize some of your work. We've got an online magazine, and I'd like to talk to you about making a contribution there. So I'll give you a call at some point.
Thanks so much.
Not too distant future. Thank you very much. Have a great week, great weekend, and enjoy your writing, your reading, and your family.
Thank you so much. Same to you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Take care now. That's been Christina Wright. She is the author or editor of Lustfully Ever After. She's one of the people that are involved with Cleus Press. You can Google her. You can see her and find her on Facebook. Any number of ways. Just remember the name Christina Wright, Christina with a K, and you'll be able to find her and her work. This has been the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we brought you an excellent conversation with Ms. Wright, and we want to make sure that you listen to us every Monday through Friday when we're on the air between 10 and 11 in the morning on the West Coast. So please listen again. We'll be back again Friday with another author from Cleus Press, as a matter of fact. And that book that we're going to be discussing is by Laurie Bryant Woolridge, The Power of Wow. And that should be an interesting conversation as well. So join us again the next time we're on. Listen for some changes that are coming to things that the Boomer and the Babe are doing, but we're not going to be changing this radio show. We're going to keep doing that. So thank you very much, everybody, for being a part of it. And remember to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and have yourself a great afternoon. Take care now.
To the Boomer and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.